In a well-known American newspaper, the Washington Post, organised an experiment. So they took one of the world's greatest violinists, they dressed him in ordinary clothes, they told him to busk for money at one of DC's busiest train stations. The article reports that he was playing a 300-year-old Stradivarius violin worth an estimated $3.5 million. He played a brilliant classical repertoire for 45 minutes straight. Just a few days before, apparently, he'd packed out a concert hall in Boston where people had paid $100 minimum to hear this guy play. But here in DC, on this fine morning, he made a lousy $32.17. Who gave him the 17 cents? The newspaper that organised it said it was an experiment in context, perception, priorities, as well as an unblinking assessment of public taste. Obviously, the newspaper was trying to show people have no taste. Now, in some ways, not fair, is it? Not fair to do that then and there, because it's morning, it's rush hour. People are on task, they're on a mission. I know what I'm like. They've got places to be, planes to catch, got to get to work, got to get to school. Some ways not fair. If they were told what was really going on, I'm sure many of them would have stopped. If they were told what was really happening, don't you think some of them would have stayed for a minute or two? You know, all right, that was good, I'm going. Stradivarius, amazing, going. See, today I want to ask the question, what's going on the cross? What's happening? What's taking place? Face value. But then I want to ask a question, what's really going on with the cross? What's behind the clothes? What's behind the, you know, look deeply? What's really taking place, really happening, deeper than face value? And that's exactly why I've chosen Matthew. Because when it comes to the cross of Jesus, the death of Jesus, Good Friday, the first Good Friday, Matthew talks about what's going on. But then, if you look deeper, he talks about what's really going on. He lets us appreciate this event on two levels, like that famous violin player. There was two levels. He lets us look at it at face value and then more. And the benefit of doing this, the advantage, the positive for us, Wilbur's always getting me to think of, well, what's the positive? What's the take home for us? The positive for us is we can go from here much more educated, much more aware. We can appreciate Good Friday, the cross of Jesus, all the more, better, whoever you are, whatever perspective you're coming from. So then, first of all, what's going on? Let's look at that. What's going on in the cross? Have a look at sentence number 32. As they were going out, they met a man from Cyrene named Simon, and they forced him to carry the cross. They came to a place called Golgotha, which means the place of the skull. There they offered Jesus wine to drink mixed with gall, but after tasting it, he refused to drink it. When they had crucified him, they divided up his clothes by casting lots, and sitting down, they kept watch over him there. So not only is Jesus here powerless to stop the abuse, powerless to fight for his life, powerless to even carry his cross up the road. Not only is Jesus powerless, he's also trapped. Now that means, listen carefully, even if he had the strength to escape, even if he had the ability to escape, he couldn't anyway. Matthew goes into all this detail here to show us, even if he had the strength to escape, couldn't anyway. For instance, in the Roman world, from what we understand, the upright of the cross, so the vertical beam, I always get those two mixed up, the vertical beam, the trunk would usually stay in the ground. It was a permanent fixture outside some of these ancient cities. Usually it was left near a public crossroads or throughfare, so as many people as possible would know that that's where it was, and they would see it as they went to, you know, as they went to work and stuff. The horizontal beam, right, by contrast, so the arm bit that your arms were on, that was carried by the person who was to be executed. The beam was carried by the victim out to the place of their death. The victim would then be tied or sometimes nailed to that horizontal beam and hoisted up on the vertical. It's the vertical that stays, that's the one that stays there. They would hoist them up, but because Jesus is so weak from being beaten, verse 30, we didn't actually read verse 30, it says they struck him on the head again and again and again. Soldiers. or so because he's so weak from being beaten, or because he's so weak from being whipped and flogged, verse 26. Again, we didn't read verse 26, but it says he was whipped and flogged, and from what we understand, that would have been horrific. Because Jesus is so depleted, he can't actually carry his own crossbeam. And so instead, the soldiers have to grab an innocent bystander to carry it for him. This bloke, Simon of Cyrene, the father of Rufus, he's conscripted in to do the job. Not only that, the soldiers then gamble to see who will get Jesus' clothes. Can you see that there in verse 35 or sentence 35? This is because victims were crucified completely naked. They were stripped bare for crucifixion. This is because the cross was a thing of shame as well as pain. And then, sitting down, the soldiers kept watch over him, verse 36. From what we understand, historians tell us that there had been situations where crucified people had been rescued by their friends. And so it was now imperial policy, the Roman government made it imperial policy, to have guards watching over at every crucifixion. And so you see what I'm saying here. Is this rubbing home? Not only is Jesus powerless, he's trapped. Even if he had the strength to escape, he couldn't have anyway. You cannot get a more weak and lowly picture. You cannot get a picture of someone more trapped and caught. If you wanted to paint a picture of someone trapped and caught, here it is. Here's a picture that will suit perfectly for your purposes. And then, if that weren't enough, comes all this mockery. And that too, let me tell you, that too shows how powerless Jesus is. Look at sentence 39. Where is it? Sentence 39. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking his head and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." Now, in his life, you need to know this bit of background. In his life, in his ministry, Jesus had predicted that he would destroy the temple. But after he'd done his work, temple would be no more. Now, if you take that literally, "I'm going to destroy the temple," Jesus' claim would be impossible for us to do in our day with our modern building techniques and technologies. It's impossible for us to do in our day, let alone in these ancient times. Even in our time, you can't destroy a large stone temple and rebuild it in 3 days. Couldn't even do it with this building. But, you know, destroy this building and completely rebuild it in 3 days. Jesus' claim that he made in his ministry to get rid of the temple, that would take godlike power, miraculous power. But he claimed that. He called it. He put his own reputation on the line because he said, "I'm going to do it." And yet here he is, humiliated, trapped, powerless. And so is it any wonder they're throwing his words back at him? They're going, here he is. This is the guy who said he was going to destroy the temple in 3 days. Ha! You know, they're throwing it back in his face. And as they do that, they highlight how far he seems to be away from being that mighty figure. You know, for somebody to be able to do that, they would have to be a mighty figure. And yet here's this guy, naked, crucified, broken down, couldn't even bear his own cross. They highlight how far he is from that powerful display that he predicted. As I said, if you wanted to paint a picture of someone trapped, someone powerless, weak and lowly, this perfect picture right here. But hold on a second, because also, like I said, Matthew wants to talk about this event on two different levels, remember? Like the violin guy. There's the outward, you know, "Oh, that's just a guy busking. What's really going on? What's happening and then what's really happening? What's going on and then what's really going on?" So that's our second point. That's point number two. What's really going on? That's our second point. Have a look at sentence 41. In the same way, the chief priests, the teachers of the law and the elders mocked him. "He saved others," they said, "but he can't save himself. He's the king of Israel. Let him come down now from the cross and we'll believe in him. He trusts in God. We'll let God rescue him now if he wants him, for he said, I am the Son of God." See, the leaders think that they are so witty, pointing out Jesus' position. And on the surface, on face value, they have the upper hand. They seem to be the ones who are right, because he does look very weak and he does look very trapped. It looks like Jesus' predictions have failed. It looks like he missed the mark by a long way. It looks like he's off by a country mile when he was talking about the work that he would do. That's what it looks like, but what's really going on? Well, the truth is, if you've read all of Matthew, if you started at Matthew chapter 1, verse 1, and you read all the way to Matthew 28 and the end of Matthew 28, if you read it all, the truth is Jesus could have saved himself if he wanted to. He could have found a way out of this situation if that were his plan. Matthew, in his gospel, has already recorded a stack of symbol-laden miracles which Jesus did. And these miracles don't just give a sense of Jesus' power to do stuff. They also give a sense of his enormous authority. Jesus, as you read Matthew's gospel, Jesus has authority over things that are seen, like diseases and disability. And Jesus has authority over things that are unseen. I'm talking about, spiritual forces, things that we can't really put our finger on exactly what's going on. He has authority to command and authority to direct. Even nature is subject to him in Matthew's gospel. Even nature is subject to him in quite amazing, dramatic ways. On one occasion, Jesus' power is so great that his disciples fear him. And you can imagine them like kind of real horror and concern on their face to be in the presence of Jesus. At the end of Matthew, there are those very, very famous words. You may have heard them before, even if you're not a regular churchgoer. You may have heard them, where he says, "All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me, therefore go." That's what he's claiming, all authority. Elsewhere, he says to Pontius Pilate he could have a huge force of supernatural beings by his side if that were needed. You put all that together, and what we actually see here is this is quite ironic, because Jesus could have saved himself if he wanted to. He could have got himself out of this situation if that were needed, if that were his plan. Given everything else he's done, I suppose is what I'm saying. Given everything else that Matthew has recorded, he could have made a way. The leaders think they're so witty, pointing out Jesus' position, and on the surface, on face value, it seems that they're right. If you're so powerful, why not save yourself? The irony is, and Matthew deals a lot in irony, the irony is, he could have saved himself. He could have found a way out. So then, next question, why didn't he then? If he could have got down, why didn't he get down? If he could have used all this great power and called on all these other, why didn't he then? Answer, because he was doing exactly what he said he would do. Look at sentence 40 closely. We've read it, but I want you to look at it again. Those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "You who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, save yourself. Come down from the cross if you are the Son of God." The temple was the meeting place between God and people. So the temple was where God and people would meet in the first part of the Bible, the Old Testament. I've written here, it was a place where people would meet God and have their sins forgiven. I've written here, a sacrifice would be given in their place for that to happen. So a sacrifice would be given so they could meet with God. And so the temple was a place of reconciliation and a clean start. So that's a good thing, isn't it? Like the temple, that's good. But the temple Jesus spoke about wasn't a stone building. Not if you read Matthew. The temple Jesus spoke about didn't have long hallways. The temple Jesus spoke about didn't have beams like this, or columns, or large windows, because the temple that Jesus spoke about when he said, "I'll destroy it and raise it in 3 days," now hold on to your hat, this is pretty big. The temple Jesus spoke about was his own body. Jesus' work was like that temple. Jesus' work achieved what people needed from the temple. What we needed, a sacrifice so that we could come back and be made together with God. That was achieved in Jesus' work. Though his work that he did was more effective, had more power, wider reach and permanent results than the temple. So it was a greater, better temple. Jesus' own work is like that temple. The temple Jesus spoke about was his own body. And so here we go. We're starting to put it together now. His body would be destroyed on the cross. His body would be stripped down to nothing on the cross. His body would be rubble on the cross. But 3 days later, he'd rise in that body, and that was all done in his body so that people could there have that sacrifice given for them, so that people there could meet with God, because true forgiveness could come, new life could come, access to God could come. The way would be clear, and as it says later on in the Bible, we could boldly come into God's presence. The leaders think they're so witty, pointing out Jesus' position. Ha ha! This is the guy who was going to destroy the temple. And on the surface, of face value, they're dead right. If you're so powerful, come down. The irony is, he could have saved himself. So then why didn't he save himself? Because he was doing exactly what he said he would do. He was destroying the temple and raising it again. By staying on the cross in humiliation, in shame, powerless, he's making himself the place where God and people can meet, because a sacrifice has been made. The thing is, the sacrifice is him. The irony is, he could have saved himself, but wait for it. The double irony is, he was doing exactly what they were mocking him for, not doing. They were mocking him for not doing it as he was doing it. They were teasing him for not accomplishing it as he was accomplishing it. They were laughing at him for not doing what he said at the very moment that he was doing it. He was destroying the temple and raising it in 3 days, but the temple was his body, the place where we would meet with God because of a sacrifice. What's going on? What's really going on? Matthew helps us see. And by the way, I only did one bit of Matthew. We could have done all the other bits of Matthew and seen a similar irony in the other parts of Matthew that we look at. So men and women, boys and girls, visitors, here we are, Good Friday. So good to have you. Good on you for coming out. For us, 9 o'clock is pretty early for our church because we normally meet at 4 or 6. So 9 o'clock, we're all a bit staggery. So good on you for coming out. We're really glad to have you. It's so good that you're here, because by coming here, you get to appreciate the cross on a deeper level. That's right, isn't it? You get to appreciate the cross at face value, and then also on this deeper level by coming out this morning. It's good for Christians to come out, like myself, Christians like myself, Miranda, Wilbur, Laura, Lyndall. It's good for us to come out to learn about the cross more and more on this Good Friday. It's good for non-church people as well, though. If you're not a regular church goer, if you don't believe, it's good for you to come out to learn more. Last thing that we want to see is people who've turned their back on God, or who said, no thanks God, without ever really knowing exactly what they've turned their back on. Now, I'm not saying that's you, but that does happen. The last thing we want is people who've turned their back on God without knowing what God has done for them on the cross, without having a full-blown appreciation of that. And so this morning is the beginning of giving a full-blown appreciation of that. As a church, we want everyone in our bit of Hobart to come to a clear understanding of the cross and interact with that, you know, really try and engage with that. So it's good to have you this morning to talk about these things with you. It's good to appreciate what happened on the cross. So what did happen on the cross? In case you missed it, what did happen? The one who was genuinely powerless. He had no power. He was gone. He was cooked. The one who was genuinely powerless was also powerful at exactly the same time. The one who was powerless was powerful to bring a way for us to truly know God and to meet with God. The weakness that the mockers find so amusing, that weakness is at the same time Jesus' own power. And by him doing that, he becomes like a temple where we can meet God and find full forgiveness. How good is that? That's amazing, isn't it? We have a saying, don't we? Familiarity breeds contempt. Do you know that one? Of course you've heard that. It means the more you get to know somebody, the more you don't need to be polite to them anymore. Because you get to know them and you kind of know how they work, and they start to annoy you. And no doubt you start to annoy them, and you see what they're really like, and you see their flaws, and so you get used to them, and you don't really feel the need to be polite, and you can actually even be a bit kind of shut up. No, you shut up. No, shut up. Have a bit of contempt. Familiarity breeds contempt. Now, that may be true of some occasions, but it's not always true, is it? Especially when it comes to appreciating a topic or a subject. Sometimes the more you get to know a subject, the greater fascination you get, especially if it's a complex subject. I've been listening to lots of science podcasts recently as I've been riding to work. The more I'm getting to know about these different itty bits of science, you know, sub-molecular level, I'm just like, wow, tell me more. You know, I'm actually coming to appreciate, I'm more engaged than ever. And I keep thinking, where was I in high school? Why didn't I care about this, you know? Sometimes the more you get to know, the more interested and engaged you get. Here today, the subject for us is the cross, and I'd like it to be the same, that we would get more engaged. The one who was genuinely powerless was also powerful at the same time, powerful to bring a way for us to know God and to meet with him because the sacrifice was given. Now, I should just say, we've only just touched the tip of the iceberg in Matthew. We could spend a lot of time on this, which we won't. There's so much more in Matthew we could. So let me just say as I finish, if you're a Christian here today, I'm going to wrap it up, but if you're a Christian here today, make sure you take time to appreciate the cross this Easter. Huh? I've written here, spend time doing exactly that. Appreciate the cross this Easter. You could pick up a book which is dedicated just to that topic, and Christians have written thousands of books dedicated to just that topic. Over the course of the next few weeks, months, you read the book. Appreciate the cross. You could learn about Matthew's presentation of the cross, Mark's presentation of the cross, Luke, John. You could do the Apostle Paul or the other New Testament writers and go, what's their presentation of the cross? You could read theoretical books about the cross, like what exactly was happening and why and how is that just and how is that merciful and is that like some kind of child abuse that the father would punish the son? Well, no, what makes it different? You know, you could get into all the theoretical elements of it. And Christians have written lots on that. You could read very practical books. Because of the cross and because of the way the cross works, we're now forgiving to others. Because God has forgiven us in the cross helps us to forgive. So you could read very practical books. You could listen to podcasts. I know some of you are loving podcasts at the moment, right? Listen to them. All to give you a deeper understanding, a greater appreciation of the cross so that you'll base your life on it. You'll allow this message to influence you more and more. Christians will sometimes come up to me and ask my advice. They'll say, I was talking to my friend the other day and he asked me X and I didn't know what to say. What should I say? Now, I'm sitting there thinking, the fact that you're asking me shows that you must be pretty desperate, that you've come to ask me for help. Christian, don't let yourself be in that position where you just don't really know what to say. You know, you want to yourself know and appreciate the cross for yourself, for others' sake. So if you're a Christian, make sure you take time to appreciate the cross. Get familiar with it. If you're not a Christian, let me just give you one word. If you're not a believer, right? Engage. Engage with it if you haven't already. Talk about it if you haven't already. Wrestle with it if you haven't already. By all means, I would love you to believe in Jesus and his cross today. I would love you, absolutely love you to put your faith in it if you want to do that. Do it. But at the very least, you know, engage with, wrestle with the topic. Don't avoid the issue. And we'll be back up here in just a sec. And my place, he's already told you what we're putting on, the Q&A night. Miranda, wasn't it great to hear from Miranda about some of the questions she had? She explained that so well. Come along to an event like that. I know you would never just avoid the issue. I know you would never just avoid this topic. That's great. Instead, I urge you to fully appreciate and engage with the cross. Just this week, just on Monday, ABC News reported that an aspiring rapper was arrested after he had gorged himself on seafood and alcohol at a Gold Coast restaurant and then fled into the surf without paying his $600 bill. Did anyone read that story? It's on Monday. Terry Peck allegedly devoured 2 lobsters, 21 oyster shooters, 21, a baby octopus, and several beers at a main beach restaurant before making his getaway. The staff from the restaurant took off in hot pursuit. But Peck ran onto the beach and into the surf, and efforts to cajole him back to shore were unsuccessful. 2 police eventually jumped on a jet ski, a lifeguard's jet ski, and arrested him out in the ocean. Peck was charged with stealing and 2 counts of serious assault of a police officer and appeared in a Southport magistrate's court on Monday. Outside the court, however, Peck criticised the meal, saying the lobsters were overcooked. Somehow, mate, I don't think that's the issue. We must all appreciate and engage with the issue, the actual issue. And here's the actual issue. Here's the issue. The cross is for you. Jesus was powerless, but in that he was also powerful. so that we might come to God. Appreciate the issue, engage the issue. Don't be so busy, don't be so on task, don't be so set in your way that you rush past, and miss out on stopping to see this great treasure. Let me pray. Oh Lord, we thank you so much that on the cross, though Jesus was powerless, shamed, humiliated, and broken down, shell of a man, but there was great power. We want to thank you so much, Lord, that in that he was providing a way for us to come to you because the sacrifice was made, a sacrifice on our behalf. May we engage the issue. May we look into it deeply, whether we're a Christian or not. May we try our very best and look our hardest to search the scriptures to understand the meaning of this event. We pray it all in Jesus' name. Amen.